Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast Mailbag episode. I'm your host, Richard Reddy, but my friends call me Spanish, so let's be friends. It's 2023 now, so I am declaring that this is now the pre-season instead of the off-season, at least in Missed Apex land. I believe I have that kind of authority and power, because last year really felt like a long, long season. And I found myself at the end of the season being glad that the race cars got parked for just a little while. It was that intense a season, I was glad to finally leave the shed and see my children's little faces for the first time since pre-season testing. Because in the olden days, in the before time, in the long, long ago that even Uncle Steve can remember, F1 seasons used to just go by in a flash. They were gone and we would be begging for more. But nowadays it's a tsunami of races in your face, wave after wave of triple headers, double headers, extra sprint races all coming at you, and then finally the mercy of December comes around and you can wipe F1 off with the warm sweet towel of the off season. But that has passed now, that has gone. I've had my Christmas dinner, I've popped my New Year's poppers, I even held out my bolsa for El Dia de los Reyes Magos. I am cleansed. I am rested. And now I want my F1 cars back. So I am declaring it pre-season here at Missed Apex. So let's kick off by answering your mailbag questions after reminding you that we are an independent podcast produced in the podcasting shed with the kind permission of our better halves. We aim to bring you a race review before your Monday morning commute. We might be wrong, but we're first. I'm joined from a wintry New York by Matt Two Rumpets. How's it going, Matt?
I have a fascinating hour, 20-minute long documentary on vehicle dynamics that I can recommend highly to you, Spanish.
I don't want to watch that.
Oh, come on.
No, I want something interesting with explosions and car chases.
Oh, okay. So kind of like Andretti in Formula One then.
Yeah. I was going to say, or just watch the 2014 season back and just look out for any Renault-powered car. That would be the one to do. We're also joined by PR guru Chris Stevens. How's it going, Chris?
Hello, Spanners. And the new year, our first live stream of 2023 as well. It's exciting times.
Yeah. Are you looking forward to the new season, Chris? Are you recovered enough?
I am sufficiently, and as you know, I very much agree with you about how this has been a bit of a slog of an F1 season, just because it's so long, and yeah. The fact that we had December off for the World Cup and lengthening that off-season a little bit was actually quite nice. I feel refreshed.
I didn't realise that. Was the F1 schedule done with the World Cup in mind?
Yes, it certainly was.
Oh, okay. Well, I learned something.
Yeah, the last race of the season was the day the World Cup started.
Ah, right. And then if you look at the season before, it went quite deep into December. So does
that
mean...
It was Christmas by the time the season ended, and it's going to be the same again this year.
Oh, okay, good. Well, okay, in that case, take a deep breath, and maybe I'm okay that there's a few more weeks of the pre-season to come. And we're also joined by special guest Matthew Summerfield, Summers F1. Don't panic. It's not a tech show. Summers, I want to get some of your opinions on like the rest of F1. Everyone asks you about aero, but no one ever asks you, do you like Carlos Sainz's hair?
And why wouldn't anybody want to ask me those kind of questions?
Exactly. So we're going to dig into our mailbag. Some people have tried to sneak some tech in, so whether or not they'll be successful later, I can't guarantee. But I want to check. I don't want to embarrass you. You do know stuff like that's not involving tyre squirt and an aero, don't you?
I kind of know a few things, yeah.
Oh, okay. And you're a fan. I peg you as a Williams guy.
Maybe back in the days, but I don't really follow one particular team anymore. Oh. It's a bit difficult to be a journalist and have a team or a driver. So, you always have to sit on the fence, don't you?
This is it, guys. This is what I forget, that Summers is actually like a proper journalist for motorsport.com and stuff. If anyone can get him to do like an inflammatory opinion and start a flame war, you get extra points. How's that?
Challenge accepted.
Not a pretend journo like you, Matt, that you've been to like how many accredited races have you been to? A couple.
Yeah. Formula E though. Formula One. Yet.
And Chris, you are no longer a journalist. Now you're in the PR world. But you still, tend to stay fairly neutral.
Yeah. I think it's just kind of in my nature where I'm more a fan of the sport.
Yeah.
I think when I was younger, I definitely was a big McLaren fan because they were a British team and at the time had two British drivers in the form of Lewis Hamilton and Jenson Button. And when I started watching, they also just happened to be the two most recent world champions as well. So, but over time, just more of a fan of the sport.
Yeah, so we're lucky. It's a really like neutral, unbiased panel with me leading as the most neutral one. So let's dig into the mailbag. Stop sniggering in the back. I can hear you from here. I can hear you typing a YouTube comment. Let's see. First up is Fred Philberg with a question. He says, I'm a new F1 fan from the US. Well, welcome to F1 fandom, Fred, who started watching after Spa 2022. I'm curious what the panel's thoughts are regarding Alpine's performance next year. Will Gasly and Ocon succeed? Will the Alpine car not explode daily? Chris.
Firstly, can I just apologise for the end of the 2022 season, Fred? There are usually more different race winners across the season than what you will have seen watching Formula One since Spa.
Fred, go back and watch the end of the 2013 season. See it for something different.
Or watch the beginning of the 2013 season, which was much more competitive than that. But
I have to say, Lewis Hamilton is very considerate. When he wins a world championship, he tends to then not win any more races. So in a Lewis Hamilton championship season, at least you get more winners towards the end. Sorry, Chris, carry on.
Yes. So to the question, Alpine took a very direct route in choosing performance over reliability in 2022, and we saw the car was indeed very competitive, and it just about worked out in their favour, where they did manage to secure fourth in the Constructors' Championship after a season-long battle with McLaren. I think it's safe to say that that battle was a lot closer than it probably should have been, especially bearing in mind that McLaren were fighting that fight with one hand tied behind their back in the form of only having one competitive driver in that car. But the Gasly-Ocon combination, I think, is a very interesting one, assuming that they are able to act in a professional manner and set their previous differences aside, which I think is maybe more possible because their differences came from both being young, up-and-coming superstars from France and usually competing for the same sponsors and competing for the same places on the same grids. But now that they're both in Formula One and both race winners, I think it might be easier for them to get along.
It's not going to be. No, you're wrong. And Matt, because Matt, obviously, you're a big supporter of Esteban Ocon, but Ocon has gotten under the skin of just about every teammate. Like, you remember, obviously, with me as a Perez fan, watching them in the Pink Panthers, and they just seem to be, clashing constantly. And Ocon, like, selfishly took up room near the barrier at Singapore that Perez was clearly always destined to occupy. And look, with Alonso is our friend, you know, like being sarcastic. They've obviously fallen out. He's got this history with Gasly as well. So like, I think Ocon's a lot more fiery behind the scenes. And it was Ocon, wasn't it, that Verstappen ended up shoving on the weighbridge. Like he has a habit of getting under people's skin, Matt.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, you can't argue with the results. And I will point out that he went two seasons with Alonso.
Mm-hmm.
And we've not seen too many people able to do that without burning the entire place down. I mean, yeah, I think Alonso had some issues with him. But yeah. I overall, the relationship remained pretty professional. What I want to talk about, hilariously, is that the main problem that Alpine had wasn't their internal combustion engine. It was just the water pump was not up to snuff. They got something about the design wrong and they weren't able to fix it.
Oh, sneaking so, in tech. Look at that.
Yeah. As far as the blowing up engines, I'm hoping that we won't see quite as many of them as we did last season.
So Summers, I'm not banning you from talking about tech in any way. And feel free just to come in anytime. I know normally when you do these tech shows, Matt asks 14 questions and then waits patiently for half an hour as you answer each one in turn. But what's your take on Alpine as a team with what you could argue is a superstar driver lineup for next year?
Well, just going back to obviously the Gasly-Ocon sort of relationship, I think when you look at the previous partnerships, i.e. Alonso and Perez, you could almost argue that it's the teammates that have been rubbed up the wrong way and Ocon's kind of just got there in the mix. However, I do think that there might be a bit of a sniping behind the scenes between Gasly and Ocon. It's probably going to come to blows at some point, especially if Alpine do have a decent car, which they do have the potential to do so this year. I think they did an exceptional job last season in terms of development on their car. They didn't have to shift development focus too drastically from what they started from, and that obviously allowed them to build momentum. They had updates all the way till almost the end of the season, whereas other teams didn't have that kind of ability to do so. And as Matt already mentioned, that one of their biggest issues with the power unit was the water pump. Now, I wasn't going to bring that up because it was tech, but already given me the shoe-in. So I do think that from a success point of view, Alpine, Gasly and Ocon could be a really threatening combination. But I don't think that Alpine have still got the ability to take it to the top three. And I think this is the biggest problem that Formula One has over the course of the next few years is closing that gap between the top three and those that are in down below them.
Are we still calling them Renault? Are we still calling them Alpine? We're not going to go with, I can't believe it's not Renault. Because part of the reason I think they went to that rebrand was, I don't know, at a guess, pressure from the board. We are the mighty Renault. We're previous world champions, we've won titles with Red Bull as an engine manufacturer. This is clearly not going well. Abitbol gets sent on his way after like not delivering on the five-year plan or whatever it was, and then suddenly they get rebranded as Alpine, which felt like a face-saving exercise. And I'm not sat on the board of Renault, but it does feel like that, doesn't it, Chris? It felt like the whole Alpine thing was just a to avert the PR quote-unquote disaster of the underwhelming Renault era.
Yeah, the five-year plan that turned into a six-year plan and then a seven-year plan and then an eight-year plan and so on and so forth.
And we have to remember that all through this, Matt, you have been the most optimistic Renault person, that they were just going to turn it around any minute. And you still have that faith even since they've been downgraded to Alpine.
Well, I don't see Alpine as a downgrade. I think I would agree with you. I think it's a moving of the goalpost by the Renault Corporation.
It's a downgrade.
as far as the power unit goes, I think they have every right to claim that they are there or thereabouts with Honda and Mercedes in terms of performance. In terms of reliability, obviously not yet. But I think the issue for all of the midfield teams, and we'll probably talk more about this later, is that I'm looking at 5 to 10 years of the cost cap we currently have before the advantage the big teams have built up over the previous decade plus they've been in the sport is actually whittled away. They have in their you know, at their command, an arsenal of tools the midfield teams cannot afford. And it's going to take a long time before those tools degrade to the point that we have real parity, the kind that the FIA and FOM want.
I think Alpine this season as well is really going to miss Alonso. Now, Matt can sit here and he's going to sit here and say, Ocon beat him in the standings, blah, 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 blah. Okay. But we all know that when those cars were working, Alonso was the one up front and scoring the big, big points. And those big explosive performances where he would suddenly bag a top five or a top six or some really, really amazing Sunday afternoon drive from Alonso. I don't think they're going to get that same thing from Pierre Gasly. I do expect Gasly to get the better of Ocon because I just rate Gasly a little bit higher, I think. And he has a bit more potential. But yeah, I don't think we're going to see those big explosive performances from them anymore.
Yeah, I don't want to fall out with Matt over it, but I'm also expecting Gasly to come in and become the de facto number one driver. But I think Matt will get, obviously you'll get your I told you so moment when if that doesn't transpire, or they put Alonso's water pump in Gasly's car.
Just like Alonso came in and thrashed Ocon.
Honestly, though, I'm
sure Gasly in a brand new team will do better.
We always, Matt, when people move teams and we have these kind of arguments over the last 8 years, we always give a few months grace, don't we, to let things balance out when a new driver goes.
I'm not really worried about it. Actually, it's a funny thing. Chris mentions the statistics because we had someone ask about teammate battles. I went and collected them all. Ocon's highest finish was fourth this season. Alonso's was fifth. So, I mean, he's equally capable of finishing at the top end of the field. We saw the battle with Hamilton at Suzuka. We saw the battle with Vettel. I think it's going to be an interesting pairing with Gasly. And I really don't know which of them is the better driver. But because Ocon's been at the team already for 2 years, I suspect this season should be a lock for him.
And you guys have tripped over another listener question that we've got from Tom, who, and I love this because we've got, you know, it was an America Land listener, Fred, from the first question. And now we're going all the way over to New Zealand. Greetings from a New Zealander that desperately wants Lawson in F1. I know this has been discussed a lot, but regardless of the new regulations, I feel that although the racing is technically closer, can we realistically see a team outside of the big three have any form of a chance to push for a title race anytime soon? From the outside view, it feels like the big three have far and away the facilities and personnel to do it. Of course, Matt touched upon this, and I'd like to get Summer's view on this first, because there was recently someone from Audi, and I believe it was Dieter Rehnken, wrote an article recently saying that Audi are really struggling to hire personnel. And I don't know where Audi are going to be based. Are they going to be based in Switzerland, Summers? Do you know?
I would imagine so.
Yeah.
As you mentioned, the biggest problem that somebody like Audi have got is being able to steal away personnel from other manufacturers that aren't locked into big contracts. And some of the bigger teams, that's essentially what they've done, is locked their personnel into really significantly long contracts in order that they can't then just play musical chairs. We all know that that's how Formula One works. Once you're in that environment, you've either got to be in and out very quickly, or you kind of stay in Formula One as a lifer because of the way that the Formula One community doesn't really transfer into perhaps other aspects of, working life that you might expect it to.
You've basically got F1, or then you go into missiles, and that's your choices once you go down that path sometimes, I think.
Yeah, so that's the difficulty I think that you've got, is that you're competing against already very established teams that have projects in the run already, whereas you've got somebody like Audi coming in, and remember, they're coming in as an engine manufacturer. They're not coming in as a constructor.
Yes.
So they've got to steal personnel from the engine manufacturers, and we've already seen that's happened between Mercedes and Red Bull. So that's already shortened the amount of people that you can take from that particular pool, and then you're on to stealing from the likes of Honda and Ferrari, and we all know how Honda works in a very different way. So I think it's going to be really difficult for Audi, at least in the early stages, but as we progress maybe 2, maybe 3 years a bit further down the line, then we should be a bit better.
I need some reminding, Summers. Okay, so Audi are coming in for the team that is currently Sauber, Alfa Romeo. Yeah, so Audi are going to be the engine manufacturer for what will that team be?
Well, I think it's going to be called Audi, isn't it? Like, it's going to be effectively the Audi Works team run by Sauber. So I'm actually sure Sauber's going to be in the name.
So it's going to be Sauber badged as an Audi, but with Audi as an engine supplier.
In the same way that Sauber is badged as Alfa Romeo now.
Right, okay.
Correct.
But then the fact that they're the engine supplier, that should sort of, it feels like that's enough to call it Audi, I guess. I don't know, like, how much of them is then spiritually still Sauber at all. Like, Sauber has become kind of almost like a rive and drive for other companies.
They're still making the car. Yeah, right. For me, a works team is an entity that creates both the chassis and the engine or power unit, which is not what Audi is doing.
Okay. Well, I suddenly feel like it was really insulting to call Sauber a rive and drive, but it does feel like they've just become like, a team for hire, almost like what you'd have, Matt, as the customer team model that we always hoped for. You know, you'd get your Saubers and a Dallara, you know, to sit and make cars and make chassis, and then someone can come in and pick and choose. But we had dreams of that kind of model maybe coming in when we were talking about this, you know, nearly a decade ago. F1 has really gone the other way, and it really wants names and manufacturers rather than that kind of, it doesn't want another Williams coming in being able to pick a Dallara chassis or a Sauber wheelbase and go racing.
Oh, no, it'd be fine, I think, with Williams if Williams had a deal with a large manufacturer to make its own power unit, for example. And this is the interesting thing about the Audi hookup. We've seen Sauber partner with BMW. Alfa Romeo is really more of just a sponsorship, a brand thing. I know they say they bring some stuff, they share some, but it's really pretty much Sauber is the operations side of thing. Audi is going to be the power unit. But the interesting thing is they will have the advantage, Sauber will, of designing a chassis in cahoots with their power unit manufacturer. And that's where we have seen the big teams, Red Bull, Mercedes, and Ferrari, be able to gain a lot of advantage over their customers.
That is assuming that they do it properly and actually communicate on those things, because it would not be the first, you know, sort of manufacturer tie-in that would not actually communicate between their engine and chassis departments.
Okay, this does inevitably and naturally lead us onto all the Andretti talk. So there are some, I actually proposed not talking about this today, and I got shouted down by the rest of the panel, except Summers, who agrees with me, because I'm not actually overexcited about this as a news story. But there are some non-team questions coming up. I think there's some fun ones about rules from another series from Kevin, which I'm going to go to next. But we are naturally moving on to Andretti. So CJ, among others, says, "Hello, Missed Apex crew. You continue to be the best and most informative podcast out there." And he didn't specify, or they didn't specify, F1. So it could be out of all the podcast topics, more informative than all the science ones. Thank you. What are your thoughts on the news that Andretti and Cadillac are teaming together to try and get to the grid? Are you hopeful, excited, heard this news before sort of thing? That kind of sums it up for me, that last sentence. Are you hopeful, excited, have you heard this news before sort of thing? And lots of people asking similar questions. So we've got Rico saying, you know, GM and Cadillac announced they are partnered with Andretti for the F1 bid. They aren't going to make an engine, though, so what are they going to do? And, of course, the FIA president, Mohammed Ben Sulayem, also kind of came out and almost publicly dressed down in a very kind of sub-tweety manner the team principals who have been opposed to another team joining. And that is predominantly Toto Wolff, but these thoughts, I've also seen them, quotes from Christian Horner and from Gunter Steiner also kind of objecting and protecting their own interest in Formula One. So I think I'll start with you, Matt. Why on earth, and this is because you're American, isn't it? Why should I be excited about this? He's right. He's right. We have heard this kind of thing before. With this kind of thing, I'm like, tell me when there's actually something happening. At the moment, I feel like there's some news that maybe a team with no actual F1, recent F1 pedigree, and a manufacturer from left field making their engines is going to make a bid to come into Formula One and do very well to do anything else but be a backmarker team. And it hasn't even happened yet. Why should I be excited about this?
You should be excited about it because it's going to finally bring American eyeballs in the numbers that Formula One has been looking for the past decade, if not more. So let's start with that. But we can also be specific and talk about Andretti in Formula One. Of course, Mario Andretti still driving race cars.
Yes. Yeah. 80?
Probably 80 at least.
And change, yeah.
Is a former Formula One world champion.
Sure.
His son, who runs the team, raced in Formula One. They have been successful in IndyCar. They have been, and they are now partnering with GM. GM, who makes Corvette, the Ferrari killer of mid-engine sports cars. Cadillac, the brand, has been immensely successful in IMSA sports cars, running prototypes in combination with Wayne Taylor Racing, I do believe. And so you've got this long history of involvement of top-level racing and racing teams, and you have the one thing that Formula One said it really needed, which is, if we are going to dilute the prize pool, you got to bring something that's going to grow it enough to make it worthwhile. Well, I mean, I don't know. Seems like a lot of marketing in America is going to come along with GM and Cadillac and Andretti.
So I think it was a impressive serve at the sort of halfway through last year when Andretti said they were launching a Formula One bid. But that serve got returned when Formula One said, oh, you have to bring something of some sort of, you know, value, as if bringing the most famous name in American motorsport wasn't enough. So they say, okay, how about this for a return serve? We'll bring you the most profitable car manufacturer of 2022 that is American, and we will bring this all-American team with at least one American driver to the Formula One grid.
Yeah.
And not only make the field more interesting, because when you get more cars, you get more storage.
Yeah,
you
I
get
think so.
Drama, you get I everything. So. Yep. It's just better when there is more. They will bring something of value. And to the point where they say they're not bringing an engine, they're not bringing an engine straight away, because there's every chance that the Andretti name will be on the grid before 2026. There is no point in Cadillac making an engine pre-2026.
Wait. Is this team, this bid, is for what year?
Well, we don't know yet. Oh, they said God. In their release, it will enter as soon as is practical.
Oh,
right?
It's going to be 2025.
So that could be. So it could be 24. It could be 25. But until then, they will need to run a customer engine, which is likely to be a Renault. And then in 2026, who knows what is possible? Because there's every opportunity that Cadillac, which, as Matt mentioned, is a historic name in American sports car racing. IMSA is like the equivalent in America of the World Endurance Championship, and they are taking on Le Mans this year as well, the 24 hours. There's every chance they'll come in as a manufacturer as well. I don't see why, you know, this isn't a big thing.
Okay, it obviously, when they arrive, it will be a big and interesting thing, but an unnamed date in the future, I think it's taking up a lot of column inches, but obviously it's the off season. But we do hear this kind of thing all the time, and these things fall through. How many news stories did we have? Porsche this, Porsche that, Porsche that, and the other. And now we like never think about it again.
But that deal got to like 99.9%
yeah, exactly.
percent of the way
so I'm telling
done.
You.
That's what good journalism is.
What did American Pie, did it teach you nothing? You don't score until you score. My goodness. Summers. I'm coming in with my theoretical new engine manufacturer eventually and my new American team based a million miles away. But given the problems we've talked about Audi having with an extant team, what chance has an outlying American manufacturer with no recent F1 engineering and competition experience actually got of making a fist of it? And I'm imagining if they don't immediately make an impact, they're going to come under huge pressure. Project Haas, I cite.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong, I firmly believe that Andretti are the team that have the best credentials to come in and basically deal with the problem that is entering Formula One, because it has been and always will be very, very difficult to go from the ground up in Formula One. And I do believe that they sit in a region that allows them to do so because of their experience. It's just a whole timing issue that I see the problem with. And I think that one of the biggest reasons that we're seeing pushback from the other teams is the commercial deals, and what was once called the Concorde Agreement has been signed until technically 2026. All the funding that has revolved around that is already set in place. And we've got Andretti wanting to come in and fill a space on the grid prior to that agreement, fulfilling its destiny. And I think that's probably where the rest of the teams have really got a bit of an issue with it. Not realistically Andretti themselves, just what has been agreed between the FOM, FIA and the teams themselves.
Okay, let's see how much interest and knowledge you have in this then, Samus. The relationship between FOM, which is Liberty Media, the commercial rights holder, that used to be CVC, what Bernie Ecclestone owned, and the relationship between that and the current FIA president, who, by the way, we've never heard so much from an FIA president. He's just active on social media. He's doing rowdy speeches on stage. They don't seem to be linking up. I'm not sure how aligned their interests are. And here's a sneaky one. I've got a feeling that there is beef between the FIA and Toto Wolff. And based on nothing at all, I think Toto Wolff has kept his powder dry for the last few years when he could have been much more Christian Hornery, because he's eventually going to end up running F1 Bernie style.
I think that might be slightly a stretch, but yeah, I agree that the one of the big issues that you have is that people perhaps don't understand how the mechanism of the FIA and FOM work. You know, Formula One management is technically the commercial arm of the business. Right. They lease that business from the FIA. The FIA are the governing body. You know, you have this situation where if the two rub up against one another, then you've got a bit of a problem there. And at the end of the day, there's only so much pie to feed off of. And I think that's primarily where the big issues are lying, is from a financial aspect. Teams are getting rubbed up the wrong way because they feel that some of their pie might be eaten away at by a new entry. But we've had this situation in the past. You look back at 2010 and the entry of those extra teams, and that caused a massive amount of controversy in those respects. And I think it's a dangerous region for Formula One to get back into, especially with a team, like you say, that has to start from scratch.
If the pie disappears, we'll just tell Mother that we ate it all. Chris.
So those three teams that came in 2010, they were all promised a cost cap that never came. We have a cost cap now.
We do. And so bring back catering.
No. I think that might be as
Marussia
stretch,
then. In you come, Marussia. Come on. Who's the other one? Who was the other one, Chris?
Lotus turned into KTM and HRT.
HRT. So let's bring those four back.
But to Summer's point about the sort of dilution of the prize pot, obviously there was this 200 million anti-dilution entry fee, which would have worked out at 20 million per team, which they're now saying is not enough to compensate for the extra team. And all the teams saying this, that, and the other, I don't think the team should be having a say in this whatsoever. It should be a Formula One and FIA decision and has nothing to do with the existing teams. But to your point, Spanners, where you're saying that these teams have no relevant recent Formula One experience.
Yes.
Who does, apart from the existing teams on the grid? Who in your list is worthy of an F1?
I just said Caterham. Virgin, Marussia, Lotus, HRT. Like, come on. No, but I would count like that as recent. But, you know, Matt has done a good job, I think, of spelling out the pedigree in other motorsports. So if you, I guess, you know, to counteract myself, Matt, I think, would you have confidence that those skills and that knowledge is transferable, given the fact that really, if you're going to succeed in F1, you're going to have to go and steal a bunch of people from Ferrari, Red Bull, Mercedes?
Well, here's the thing. For the power unit, yes. But we know, we believe, and Summers will correct me when I am wrong, that they have already a power unit supply in place. Now, if you pay your $200 million fee and you come in 2024, that's each team getting $10 million a year for 2 years till we're into the new regulations. And they can argue about how much of the 50% the teams currently get, the teams should get if there's an 11th team. They can negotiate that then. But I was curious. So I did this thing where I divided 50 for 50% by 10, and I got 5. And then I divided it by 11, and I got 4.54%. So on a per team basis, you're talking about like 0.46% less. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if they bring in 100 million new American viewers, well, I'm pretty sure my marketing team's going to tell me that we're making more money with the extra eyeballs than we're losing with that 0.46 of a percent that we've now handed over to Andretti, which has already offset it with like $10 million a year anyway, if they happen to come in before 26.
My favorite part of that was when you slowly read maths out loud.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Summers, you'd be a good aerodynamicist. You do you do quite a lot of hand-drawn tech drawings. And like, you're a really good artist, but how much of that is artistic license and how much of it is based on aerodynamic knowledge?
Well, it's mostly artistic license, isn't it? You know, I'm explaining how things operate in a general sense, but... If you're asking if I want to be an aerodynamicist,
yes,
for Andretti, it's not happening, is it?
Actually, it was more of an excuse to point people at your work, because I believe you are the best F1 tech communicator out there. There's some strong competition, increasingly so. Are you annoyed at the amount of new good techie people that have come in? Because it used to just be you and Scarbs.
It did. Well, there was always a few of us, if you talk worldwide. But yeah, me and Craig are pretty much there or thereabouts in terms of, you know, the social medias, yeah. Let's put it that way, and the way that we came through that sort of ranks. But yeah, there's a lot of new people appearing, but there's a lot of people appearing on different sorts, yeah, of tech, you know, doing things like with simulation data, etc. So I think there's a lot of room for what we do. Mm. It's a niche topic anyway, so you either like it or don't.
It's a rising tech tide, which would raise all ships. Any interesting Summers articles that we should point people to and put a link in the show notes of?
Well, over the Christmas period, as is usual, I did my annual review of every single team obviously showed the development throughout the course of the season. So those articles are out there. If you go to my Twitter, you can follow the thread. And I do have, over the course of the next few weeks, another set of a mini series of articles coming out, looking at all the tech from last year and where that might have an impact on the development for 2023 as well.
Excellent. So Matt, why don't we get a link to that in the show notes? And also we can get a link to The Last Tech Time as well, and The Last Tech Segments, hosted, of course, by Matt Two Rumpets. Ah. Okay, a couple of less heavy ones here. We've got, we'll give this one some lip service. James from Canada says, would you rather have Carlos Sainz's hair, Nigel Mansell's moustache, or David Coulthard's chin? There you go, Chris. What would you rather have? And why is it Nigel Mansell's moustache?
No, it is definitely not Nigel Mansell's moustache. I know they're sort of coming back, but I still feel like they have a certain aesthetic that would not suit me. And I already have Carlos Sainz's hair. So it would be DC's chin, because anytime somebody wanted to punch me in the jaw, it'd just break their hand.
Yeah, I'm torn, because as a round facer, as someone with an incredibly round face, I do look at David Coulthard's chin with some envy.
But, you know, the facial hair works really well on a round face, as proved by the actor John Sim.
And also proven by the fact that when I accidentally didn't put the guard on my razors and had to, and then I ended up having to shave my whole face recently, my daughter nearly cried, and my wife treated it like we sat everyone down and she was like, right, it's going to take a couple of weeks for daddy's facial hair to grow back. And it's just a difficult time we're all going to have to go through. But Nigel Mansell's moustache is so iconic that when I've seen him in recent interviews without it, like I'm physically upset that where is Nigel Mansell's moustache?
He's unrecognisable.
Yeah. And of course, Summers is competing for the prize of best hair with Carlos Sainz.
Obviously.
Yeah.
But I would go for Mansell's moustache as well, because clearly I need to hide some of what's going on here. Yeah. And that would offer the best way of doing so.
There you go. There you go, James. Hope you're happy with yourself. There is a question here from Kevin or Kozo. Hang on. Cool. Wow, we've gone all around the world, haven't we? So we've had Canada, America, New Zealand. Let's assume that Kevin is from Madagascar. Kevin from Madagascar says, if F1 could adopt a rule from another series, which would you get? Well, what do you think, Chris? Could F1 steal some rules from other series?
Pro-Am lineups. As in we get like amateur racers to come and swap in and do a stint, just a bunch of middle-aged businessmen, they do 30 minutes each race.
It got to a point, though, in F1 a few seasons back where, you know, especially like with Mazepin, Stroll, Latifi, it was starting to look a little bit like that. And thankfully, Guan Yu Zhou has looked reasonable. Otherwise, that could easily look like a pro-am business arrangement.
I'm talking about proper AMs, like the ones you get at Le Mans and the Spa 24 Hours that get in the way of all the pros. No, for real, it would be the return of some form of push to pass system, like the old KERS. And I know they're, you know, upping the battery power for 2026. I would love that to go back into manual control and allow the drivers to deploy it strategically in wheel to wheel combat.
Okay, so before the hybrid era, and I'm sure Summers is going to correct me on the dates, it was before 2014, wasn't it? Like 2011 we had KERS?
Well, so technically, if you want to be really coy about it, as I'm sure Summers would say, technically KERS, when it was introduced in 2009, was also a hybrid era, because it was technically a hybrid engine.
But
in
terms
of the proper hybrid era, as we know, it started in 2014.
What I'm saying is before the turbo hybrid era, if you
that's
like, before
2014,
there was some reclamation of kinetic energy, which got stored, and they could press a button, and couldn't they get like 10 seconds, Summers? 10 seconds of boost?
It was 6.66, if memory serves. It was 80 horsepower, and I can't remember the kilowatts of power that they had off the top of my head.
2011?
It was first actually introduced in 2009, but Braun and Red Bull didn't run it. Only the likes of McLaren did, and the system was really heavy, and so it was basically abandoned for a year in 2010, came back in 2011 until 2013.
Excellent. But okay, so from a tactical point of view, though, it did afford something genuinely interesting. And when you played your Vidya game, that was quite a cool thing to have. Oh, when should I deploy my extra power? And I don't think that would be too gimmicky to bring back something like that when half the car is now battery. Surely now more than ever, you've got a chance to do it. And I guess they do it to some extent, but it's all done with modes. And from the engineer's point of view, and it's kind of all preset, are you going to be regenerating mode? Are you going to be attacking mode? Are you going to be using up your power? Or are you going to be somewhere in between?
I think the biggest thing about Kurz was that it was something that people could actually see. You know, it was a visual thing that they could see on the broadcast. And so it made it obvious to you that it was, from a strategic point of view, the driver was in control of it. But obviously behind the scenes with the turbo hybrid era, those things are all happening. We just don't know they're happening unless suddenly, you know, they lose 160 horsepower down the straight because they've suddenly got no power for the MGUK to push along. In a very similar scenario, I've talked about this on other occasions, but my way of improving the series would be to do with DRS in a very similar way, in that I don't believe the way that DRS operates at the moment is probably the most efficient way of using it. We should basically use it as a push-to-pass system, and you should have so many pushes per race, and then that way it becomes a strategic aspect. Mm-hmm. You can use it for attack and defense, and you know the drivers are in control of when they're using DRS rather than having a pass that is arbitrary going to happen. You know, that's why I think people have a big problem with DRS right now.
Well, let's say if we dispensed with DRS, and by DRS I mean the mechanism by which when you are a second behind the car in front at a certain activation point, you're allowed to open the rear flap and give yourself less drag for the whole of that straight until you hit the brakes again. So let's say they got rid of that. You've still got the technology. You've still got all the buttons. I don't think it would be technically difficult to, as you say, go, right, okay, well, you're allowed 10 minutes of DRS in the whole race. Go for it. Or, you know, probably less. Chris?
Yeah, so DTM ran DRS where it was a certain number of seconds. I think it was something like 200 seconds or, you know, it's 200 seconds of like push to pass in IndyCar, for example. But yeah, the big difference for me between the pre-turbo hybrid Kurz and what we have now is that it was in the driver's control. They would push that button and they would deploy it themselves. Whereas now it's just all done by, you know, some automated system. And the only real difference is when you tell them, oh, you can use the overtake button, and even then all they're doing is getting more power of what they're already getting, if that makes sense. And it's okay. And they only, you know, for reliability reasons, are only allowed to use it like once a weekend.
Okay, question here: what problem are we solving? I don't know if that's Matt. What
purity
problem?
Of racing?
Purity of racing, but okay,
but not okay, not purity of racing. I think getting rid of super easy DRS passes and giving an extra strategic tool in wheel-to-wheel combat.
Purity of racing. I just want to say, like, 2000s kids say what? Because if you were F1 in the 90s, you can take your purity of racing and you can stick it up your blown diffuser. That was dull. There were some dull races in the 90s. Matt?
I think what we're solving is the quality overtakes problem. If you were going to allow both drivers to deploy DRS for a fixed time limit across a Grand Prix, well, now I can employ it defensively or offensively, and I've increased the amount of driver skill required and strategic thinking on the part of the team, and how I deploy that in order to get to the end of the Grand Prix as quickly as possible. But for me, as much as I love Summers and his wild idea of driver-controlled DRS push-to-pass, the rule I would change? Easy. I would take the red flag rule from Indy and I would use it in Formula One from tomorrow to the end of time.
No. Well, okay. First of all, set out what is the red flag rule and I'll tell you why you're wrong.
It's very simple. If you, through your own actions.
Oh, that one. Yes, you're right.
Cause another driver to not be able to complete a lap in qualifying, your best lap gets deleted.
I love that.
That's a simplification of it, but for all intents and purposes, that's how it would work.
I thought at first you were referring to red flags, you know, towards if there's a late safety car and then do what they did in Baku in 21 and have a two-lap shootout. And, you know, my concern there was if that became the norm, race directors would become like race director crack. You could be like, oh my God, I can make it so exciting. And then you're going to have someone in their ear going, this is a really boring race, but we could have a really exciting final, and you would have them every other race. But this one is not only is it a no brainer. Oh, it should be like, of course, if you foul in qualifying three and you disadvantage everyone else, that should be taken away. But how often did we have that happen and we went,
there I am at Monaco, oopsies.
Yes.
Sorry, Max.
Bottas has done it. Rosberg's done it. Leclerc's done it. Schumacher's done it. Most of them have done something like that in their racing careers. But oh my goodness, was there clutching of pearls any time we suggested that it was a bit dodgy? And the Perez one, where there's now allegations that he admitted that he did that on purpose at Monaco. I think they were all on purpose. So like, I'm just going to say, like the Rosberg one, where he robbed Hamilton of getting it at Monaco, probably on purpose. Perez allegedly said it was on purpose. Schumacher one, parking at Raskas, blatantly on purpose. The Leclerc one, maybe on purpose, but he went too far and broke his gearbox. There was a Bottas one, I can't remember where it was, but it was so blatant that he caused the yellow flag at exactly the time that would stop Hamilton having an attempt in Q3. So yeah, I'm going to say it, all those drivers cheated on purpose, Chris.
And the only one of those that you listed that got punished was Schumacher.
Yes.
At Monaco.
Well, that was also the most blatant one. Like, you need to at least sacrifice your front wing. If you're going to do that, you need to like just go nose in at least, don't you? It's a good rule, Summers. Am I being too... Do you want to defend the drivers? Go on, tell me. Tell me a driver would never...
I'm not going to defend anybody, to be perfectly honest, because as we've all just... bore witness to, I think we can suggest that all of those incidents were drivers pushing things over the edge for their own advantage.
Yeah. We want to live in a moral world, don't we? We want to live in a world that our mothers would be proud of, but it's not that. It's motorsport where everyone will cheat.
The question
at any
is, Spanners, would you do it? Would you have done those things?
So, recently... Okay, look, this is not motorsport, but playing Catan with my wife, my 10-year-old and my 12-year-old, you're meant to get rid of half your cards if they roll a 7 and bring out the robber. When a 7 comes up and I'm sat there with a bunch of cards, I keep quiet and I don't say a thing until my daughter starts counting everyone's cards. So I would say I would probably seek any advantage that wasn't blatant cheating if I could get... No, I would cheat. Yeah, whatever. I would cheat, yeah.
You helped a driver in the F3 Cup that we run on iRacing to get pole position last season, if I remember correctly.
I didn't.
You can say it was a mistake all you want, but there was a very good slipstream that he conveniently got.
I did try and manipulate it so Carl Powell would win the F3 Cup. And also I cheated in the IndyCar practice that we had yesterday and I completely got away with it. And no one knew what... do you know what? I fudged. I'm not going to go into it. It's boring. But yes. I think to answer your question, Summers, I think most of us, you get into that high-pressure environment and there's an exploit that you know, because the drivers, they know when they saw Rosberg's one and the timing of that and they saw Perez's one, they all would have known. And they know, if they'd not already thought of it, you go, yeah, that's a great idea. All right, Matt, let's move on. Have you got any questions that have tickled your mailbag senses?
Yes, but they're not for me. They're for Summers.
Oh, go on then. Go for it. Let's sneak in some tech.
And he knows where I'm going with this.
Yeah, as long as it's not anything... Oh, you're going to talk about flaps, aren't you? I knew you were going to make it that.
Tell me, I haven't lost my mind in thinking this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen in my life.
Are we talking about the spray adjusters?
Oh, spray adjusters.
As I've decided to name them.
Spray adjusters. Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
Yes, I don't think you've lost your mind.
Oh,
I think somebody's collectively lost their mind in terms of thinking that this might be a solution that Formula One will adopt.
Wait. Sorry, Summers. Is there a question though, Matt? I don't want to the person who emailed us.
From T. Tylus, no less, wanting to know the probability of seeing tests. Maybe they'll put it on F2 cars first. Will they solve the rain? Will they be part of the assembly? Will they come on and off with the wheels? He had all of the great questions for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we perhaps might see some kind of beta test throughout the course of this season, just as we did with the wing mirrors that we're going to get for 2023. We've got huge wing mirrors coming in compared to what we've had in the past. But this is a bit of a different problem to solve. And also, it doesn't really solve many problems. In fact, it might exacerbate some of them. And certainly it might disadvantage some teams more than others. And I think that's perhaps where the teams will have a really big pushback against something like this. And the other thing that I don't think anybody's really maybe thought about in this scenario is the impact that it might have on the tyres themselves in terms of temperatures and all of that sort of thing. So there's a whole slurry of things that I think potentially might derail this scenario. And I don't really think it's ever going to happen, but at least I suppose they put it out there.
Matt, would you sponsor a mud guard, a mud flap? We could get the M on a mud flap.
I absolutely would. And I guess if I'm the marketing department, maybe I'm excited about this because now I've got more room on my car to sell. But the thing that struck me when I looked at it is that they are trying to solve the problem of spray and visibility when it's full wets condition because of the change in the aerodynamic regulations. Now the spray is thrown directly back at the drivers so they can see absolutely nothing in conditions where when there was more of, I guess you would call it an outwash kind of aerodynamic regulation set, they had a little better visibility, but the tires aren't in line with where the drivers sit, number one. And number two, just if you look at a picture of where the spray is coming from, to me, it looks like it's the diffuser that's throwing all that water up and back at the driver behind. And I'm just curious if you've heard anyone talking about it or had any thoughts along those lines yourself.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's an aerodynamic issue, isn't it? And I think that's perhaps where a study needs to be delved into by FOM in advance of that, which I believe that they're undertaking at the moment. And then that will obviously breed into something being done from a physical sense as well, in order to see what happens in real world conditions. Because as we've learned this year, or should I say last year now, what the teams expected in reality didn't actually pan out in many ways, because what we had was porpoising, which a lot of the teams didn't expect. So there are some things that in doing testing from a simulation point of view don't bear out in real life. And so I think for us to be able to go down this particular route might not just be something that can be just turned on. It might take a long time to put into place, and have Formula One and Formula One teams got the patience to let that happen.
Chris?
There's a really good question from Mike Stoner about what happens if it starts raining mid-race. Do they have to pit to attach the mud flaps? And I think they already addressed this, where they said this is more of a situation where at the start of the race, they'll put it on, as in, you know, before the lights go out, whereas it's not something they intend to do.
No, I'm seeing it more like an awning, where you have someone come out with one of those little twizzly sticks and you just go to each corner winding it down, like in a restaurant at the end of the day, Matt.
It's like a James Bond thing. You push the button and the thing comes out and the thing comes back, and then you're good to go.
Go it's, gadget it's... flaps.
Exactly.
Okay, that killed that one. EJ suggested that maybe in our live chat, by the way, EJ suggested that maybe we just, you know, don't go to rainy places at rainy times of the year. And I can't remember if I said it on this show or somewhere else, but I'm sure there was a few years in Formula One where we just didn't have any wet races, and it was just scheduled that we just seemed to match all the seasons to dry periods. And there was complaints about that. People were complaining there was no wet races.
In fairness, it absolutely hammered it down in Monaco last year in the middle of May, and that's, you know, supposed to be sort of early summer, so not really a lot you can do there. And then Singapore, it has racing in Singapore and avoiding the wet season is quite difficult, because that's, you know, 364 of the 365 days.
Oh, okay, I didn't know that.
close enough. And then I can't remember where else it rained. Oh, Japan. That was it. And I think they did actually move that race forward a little bit, especially after the events of 2014, which was in the middle of typhoon season.
I love the fact that there's probably a lot of non-British F1 fans that think that Northampton and Silverstone is like this sunny paradise.
Yeah.
Because they always do the Grand Prix when it's absolutely sweltering. And any time I've been to Silverstone for F1, it has been like fully roasting.
You didn't obviously go into the race in 2008, then, did you, Spanners?
You didn't go to the race. Oh, the bog. Was that the famous bog where people were stuck and people couldn't get out?
2012 as well, when pretty much any time there's been a light sprinkling in Northampton, that pretty much happens.
Oh, and then you will need better tyres. So we're going to do a tyre question, Matt. There you go. Little treat for you, probably to end the show with. Little tyre question for you lot, but I'm going to cruelly put it to Chris first.
Oh,
so
God.
This is from Anthony Fitzpatrick, who says, do you think F1 should go back to 2010 in having two tyre suppliers instead of solely relying on Pirelli?
Yeah, so I think they mean 2006, because that was the last time we had two tyre suppliers at the same time. In 2010,
really?
we had Bridgestone tyres in 2010 as a sole supplier.
Oh, okay, hang on. We need to do some history of F1 tyres here then.
So there was a tyre war what was it, about 20 years?
Right, and that was where you had like the Ferraris and a couple of other teams on
Bridgestones
and everybody else on Michelins.
Because they were better, yeah.
Well, yeah, but didn't Bridgestone was Ferrari, wasn't it? So they liked to work solely with Schumacher. And I think the consensus is that Schumacher did have this huge tyre advantage because they were really directing everything at his car.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
But I think there is a general across the board understanding that the best motorsport tyre supplier is Michelin. Hmm. Because if what you need is a high grip, low wear tyre, then it is the best thing. It's why they're used everywhere in endurance racing.
So it's easy for F1 fans to forget that, like, Pirelli aren't, they don't, those tyres don't wear out because that's as durable as they can make them.
Exactly.
Pirelli could easily make a race tyre that lasted a thousand laps. They could make go-kart tyres that you never change if they were asked to.
Exactly. And they do have an endurance racing pedigree, particularly in GTs as well. That's just proof that they can do it. The problem with a tyre war is that it is unsustainable in terms of the funding. It created problems. We all remember the events of Indianapolis 2005, which all happened because one tyre manufacturer could not safely complete the race and the other one said, tough.
Yep.
And going back to your point about the high deck tyres, we would have to lose that because you would never, ever, ever get two tyre manufacturers to achieve the same level of deg and be honest about it. Because one of them will always sneakily make it last a little bit longer and then the other one will get a little bit longer and we just end up back where we were in the Bridgestone days where there's no strategy.
Matt, do you have any opinions on tyres?
Oh, you know, not really. They're just round things that go on.
Okay, then Summers? No, go on then, Matt. Go on.
No, I find myself annoyingly having to agree with Chris. I don't think we are in a regulatory environment where competitive tire manufacturing is going to be helpful to the overall ideal of controlling costs in Formula One. Because after all, if I'm Pirelli and let's say Hankook comes in, well, now I'm going to have to spend a lot of money making tires, a lot more developing tires than I would have. And it's also going to be complicated because, like, depending upon which teams buy my tires, now I test for those teams, but not with the other teams and vice versa. So you're going to see, because we all know that tires are the biggest single advantage in terms of getting them to work right that you can have, you're going to see if someone gets that kind of advantage, they'll be uncatchable throughout the whole course of a season. And right now we have a reasonable degree of parity as far as the tires go on the cars.
Tire war, Summers?
No, thank you. It just wouldn't. It wouldn't work, as the aforementioned has proved. The biggest issue is that Pirelli, I think, take a huge amount of flack for what product they provide to Formula One. And yes, we've seen them have issues in the past. However, you also have to remember that a lot of the issues that have been caused in the past have been caused by the teams, and they've got away with it. I'm thinking of the Silverstone incident back in 2013 when all the teams were tyre swapping, and obviously they shouldn't have been doing that. So no, is the simple answer. No to a tyre war for me. I think it would be a bad idea for Formula One right now.
And of course, it's worth remembering, just reiterating that point, it is their brief to make a tyre that does not last a long time. We want to see two, maybe even three stop races in a Grand Prix. It's what's been asked of them by Formula One.
And I think that that gives F1 a level of control over the entertainment. So we do need to say, right, okay, if we had no tyre wear at all, and those tyres could just last forever, which Pirelli could easily do, that would take away a huge element of strategy. So as much as actually some people in our Patreon live chat were saying when we were talking about push to pass and the DRS solution, you know, where you could choose how much DRS to use, you know, someone came in and said, well, why not have Mario Kart green and red shells as well? So it's seen as a bit of a Mickey Mouse thing, but we're already so used to the tyres being able to dictate and add a strategy element. So you can almost go with all that other stuff. If you're going to have this strategy element of tyres and deliberately wearing, it really, you know, having joker laps and shortcuts and DRS whenever you want to open it and push to pass, I think that is all on the table. All those things are a legitimate part of motorsport. But the gut reaction to any of these ideas to increase the entertainment or add strategy elements always gets greeted with, we'll just add Mario Kart shells. When really, motorsport is a sandbox and we can do what we want. And with the Pirelli tyres, Matt, they are able to, like, in fact, the thing that they probably just need to refine is looking at particular tracks and going, right, if it's Monaco, let's just find a way. Let's have a specialist Monaco tyre where they have to make at least three stops at Monaco. Same with Singapore.
Yeah, and these are the kinds of things where if you only have a single manufacturer, can be negotiated with the FIA as you go forward. But the real issue is just getting Pirelli the information they need in terms of the amount of downforce the teams are going to bring in order to design a tire that can run at race car pressures, which is still really a battle that's being fought in a lot of ways.
No, I got it completely the wrong way around. Monaco tires should have no grip. Do like a super hard, yeah, you don't ever have to change it, but you cannot get that thing turned. Turn Monaco into basically a boat race.
Well, the problem that you mentioned there as spanners is normally when tire manufacturers are looking at outlier circuits, it's usually because they have super high tire wear and they're having to look at it from a safety point of view. And usually what they do is they just remove the softer compounds from their selection for that particular weekend. It's very rare to have a situation where you're saying there's not enough tire wear, or they can control it too well around Monaco and creating a super duper high deg tire specifically for Monaco is going to be an expensive solution.
Groove tires. They already just get the groove tires out of the museums from 2007. No, stop putting your head in your hands, Matt. I think, look, the problem that F1 faces, one of the biggest problems with all of these things, DRS and tire wear, is you have the Tilkodromes, which are, I'm going to say it, the best F1 tracks for modern F1 cars.
Some of them are.
They are.
Some
of them. Bring back, I said it to Uncle Joe, so bring back India, Malaysia, Shanghai, the Korean Grand Prix. All those tracks are great tracks. Okay, and they suit modern F1 cars. But I don't want to not go to Barcelona, Hungaroring as well. So tell me this will work. Let's have a historic track tire and a Tilkodrome tire. Get in. Well done, spanners.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that there's so many variables. And obviously, when you come to the teams looking for performance, at the start of the season, they're obviously going to have problems with the tyres, and you're going to get better as you go on through the rest of the season. So perhaps there needs to be a mid-season break for Pirelli, where they bring a new set of tyres that works against what the teams have done in the start of the season. They'll argue against that.
So Pirelli can actively try and foil the way the teams have, say, got over the tyre wear.
Why not?
Yeah, I like it. I like it, Chris.
They already make five different types of tyre. Surely this is enough.
No. I think, you mark, watch this space. I guarantee you this idea is going to take off. Tilkodrome tyre, historic tyre.
If anyone from the FIA is listening,
yep,
you better be taking notes.
You better take that seriously. All right. I think we have time for one last question. Look, 2023... my New Year's resolution was to stoically stick to our strict 60-minute, one-hour time limit, which is why, I know, hold your booze, this will have to be the last question. All right, let's go. Let's go to Summers for this last question here. First, when do you think we will see a title fight that does not involve Max, Lewis, or Charles Leclerc? Is there any chance of this year being between Sergio Perez, Carlos Sainz, and George Russell? And that is from Sarah.
Well, I think the biggest problem that you've got with that, Spanners, is the inter-team rivalries and the authority that certain drivers hold within those teams.
Yes.
So I think if Mercedes got in a position where Hamilton and Russell were in a position that Russell could win the championship and it meant that Hamilton had to play the team player, I do think that might work. However, I'm not so sure that you could get Leclerc to play that role for Sainz, or you could get Verstappen to play that role.
That is interesting.
Perez.
That is interesting. We're going to have to break down that specific point. Chris, we'll roll around to whatever you were going to move that onto next. But which of those drivers that they mentioned first, Max, Lewis, Charles, which one of those would play second fiddle if it came down to it? I do think Lewis Hamilton would play a supporting role if it came down to it. I'm not really sure about that. I'm not going to put my house on it, Chris. What do you mean he has done before?
No, do you remember in Hungary 2017 when Bottas was trying to have a go at, I think it was Raikkonen?
Yeah.
And then they said, let Lewis have a go. And then he couldn't do it. And on the last lap, he let Bottas back through, sacrificing points for his own championship fight against Sebastian Vettel. So he has done it.
That wasn't for a title, though. That was paying back.
It was.
That
in
was
2017,
paying back.
It was.
No, hang on. It wasn't supporting Valtteri Bottas's title push. That was returning a favour as well, because hadn't Bottas already given up a place for Hamilton that year? So it would have looked very mean-spirited if he'd have then decided to go, actually, I need the points.
Well, probably. But then Lewis has never really lost a title to a teammate other than to Nico Rosberg in 2016. And there was no other competition that year.
There
were circumstances that year.
2017, there was competition that year. My goodness, have you forgotten 2017? Oh, 2016.
No, 16 when Rosberg won it.
All right, yeah. I don't know. Honestly, I'm not going to bet my house or career or anything on Lewis Hamilton doing that, but I do think that I would. It's more likely that he would, but I can't be sure, Matt.
Well, here's what I would say. I think if it is a close run thing, you would get none of those drivers to give up. But I think if, for whatever reason, the first 10 races of the year, Lewis Hamilton doesn't finish because his engine blows up into a fireball,
okay,
I don't think he'd have a problem supporting Russell.
I think
similarly, I think you could, at a certain point, offset. You would get Leclerc to support Sainz.
No. Nope.
I think he would.
No, I'll
tell
you. I
think he would. I think he would be realistic about it. But again, at a certain point offset, you would. I don't think you would ever get Max.
If you
to support the other driver at Red Bull, even if there was no way he could win, and if he supported him, it was 100% guaranteed the other driver would win.
If I was Charles Leclerc and I had decided I didn't want to support Sainz's title push and the team had told me to, I would be setting up sentries around my car at nighttime before race time, because there will be a cracked gearbox, there'll be a spring and a sprocket going astray. Ferrari would find a way. And they've done it before, Matt. They've done this before. Ferrari will find a way to make one driver, giving them the advantage over the other one.
Yeah, I think the problem for the Sainz scenario is that we have new management at Ferrari.
Oh, yeah. Leclerc's busy.
Last year, I could have seen it happening, because I think Binotto would have... If it had been obvious Sainz was the closest thing they had to a champion, the team would have supported him.
Mm.
I'm not so sure the team will let it get that close this year, if you know what I mean.
Chris Stevens.
So in terms of those three drivers being able to fight for a world championship, I would say Perez, no. Sainz, unlikely. Russell, maybe.
Jeez,
maybe
this
even.
Is savage.
It's been nice having you on the show,
I know,
Chris.
but here my the end of my sentence, because I think that before any of those three drivers would fight for a title, Lando Norris would fight for one first.
Lando Norris doesn't have... No, Summers, tell him why he's wrong.
The gap. Let's just talk about the gap between the top three.
But he wouldn't be at McLaren. This is Audi.
This is a massive caveat you're throwing into the works there, Chris.
Yeah. Hang on. There's so much that's got to happen. A, that's not happening this season. B, he would have to move to Audi. C, Audi would have to make Sauber a championship winning team.
Well, okay, hang on. I'm just answering the question the next title fight that isn't between those three drivers with Max and Charles and Lewis, which, let's be real, is going to be the short-term future of Formula One.
I think so.
So the next best thing, I think, is going to be Lando Norris at Audi.
I've got some issues. George Russell, I don't think he's the finished article yet. I don't think he's as fast as Lewis Hamilton on a Sunday. I think George Russell can win a world championship. He's going to bring home world championships that have been won by other drivers in the past. You swap him in for Vettel in 2013 or 2011. I think George Russell's winning the title. And I think Carlos Sainz could win a title as well. I think those are egregious, Matt, and I think your face summed up my feelings.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the problem you have there is there's probably about half-ish the grid that if you gave them that kind of a car advantage, they could bring home a world championship. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about, will we see the second drivers in the top three teams, any one of them actually win a title? The last time we saw that was Rosberg in 16. So, no, I don't think it's very likely, unfortunately, that we'll see any of them seriously contending for it.
Okay, well, I can give you a recent example of the let's say the Red Bull side of this this debate. 2008 featured the best Grand Prix car in history. The Ferrari 2008, best Grand Prix car that's ever been made.
Really?
Cases are being really made, was. If you're listening.
To get Felipe Massa that close to being world champion, that was the best car that has been ever produced. And for Lewis Hamilton to get just past him, to pip him on the line when Timo Glock deliberately let him pass to steal Massa's world championship. But that was a situation, I think, that you could realistically see at Red Bull. Because remember, Raikkonen was the world championship driver at that Ferrari team in 2008. And he supported and actively supported Felipe Massa. How many races do you think Verstappen would have to retire from and have Perez win in a dominant Red Bull car before Verstappen turned around and said, I'm supporting Perez's world championship bid?
More than Lewis retired from in 2016, that's for sure. Can I also just reiterate for anyone... Right, that when Spanner says Glock deliberately slowed down because they posted that clip on the F1 Instagram like this week, and the comments were filled with garbage He is joking.
No, I'm joking. No. To be clear, like, go and rewatch that, and there's the onboards from Glock, and you can just see, like, the second they made the decision not to pit and stay on dry tires, you could see how much both of those cars in that team. Which team was it? Toyota?
It was Toyota. Yeah.
You can see how much both of them were just struggling the whole lap. That would have been 4D chess to work out and go, all right, well, on the last lap, Hamilton's going to come through. actually, it's worth going back and watching that race because all the commentary, I think, all including Ferrari, they were all watching Vettel in front of Hamilton. And this is why Ferrari celebrated at thinking Massa had won, because Hamilton didn't overtake Vettel. He needed to overtake Vettel to finish fifth. And as they were crossing the line, Hamilton was behind Vettel. Ferrari starts celebrating, going absolutely nuts, not realizing that they had both overtaken a Toyota, which could reasonably have been being lapped in that era. You could reasonably have gone, oh, they just passed a lapped car.
He was so much slower that it did look like a lapped car. Back marker. Yeah. You wouldn't have thought anything of it.
Sorry, I was joking. Yeah, I forget that needs clarifying. I do beg your pardon. But answer the question. Okay, there you go. Let's go to Summers. What would it take for Verstappen to support a Perez title push?
I think you've already covered it, really. I'm glad I threw a load of E10 fuel on the start of this conversation anyway. I think it would really need Perez to have performed beyond the limit we've seen from him before, and it would require Verstappen to basically have had 10 failures.
Oh, okay, but look at 2009, where you had Barrichello and Button you could probably argue, yeah, Barrichello's towards the end of his career, Button probably overall on talent. But that could have been a couple of engine failures from Button, and that could have been Barrichello winning the first six races. So you get a situation like that.
Yeah, it's more than possible. And but the momentum shift, I think, in the mid-season from the Verstappen camp might overwhelm what has already happened in those, you know, the early scenario of what you've just come up with. So I don't think it would be so much set in stone until it was basically irreversible. You know, you've got to be at an irreversible point in the championship.
Basically, if you're at the point where Perez retires every race to the end of the season and still wins, then I think Max supports him.
I mean, it's so much harder to get into that situation now because there are so many more races than there were back then. And there is a much bigger difference between the points between first and second now, like back in that 09 era you were talking about, spanners. Like a win was actually worth very little. It was only two more points second place was. And I think, you know, for Perez, he would need to be on the same form he was in Saudi Arabia in 2022, where he was on pole position and was, you know, leading the early stages of the race, got unlucky with the safety car timing, which is what cost him the race. Really, you would need him to be in that form for the entire season. And I don't see that happening.
I have a question, though. Do you think this is a Perez-specific thing with Verstappen? Do you think it was a different driver at Red Bull, like, I don't know, maybe some Australian whose name I can't remember right now, Ricardo. Do you think he might be more willing?
It seems personal, doesn't it? It does seem like there's some beef between Verstappen and Perez. And I think that I think conspiracy theories, if you want. Yeah, let's do it. Perez started the season too well in 2022. Because he was looking really strong. He was looking quite strong in Barcelona, could arguably have held off Verstappen, or at least attempted to, but he got ordered to let it go by. He wins in Monaco with the help of that Q3 accidental spin and was looking genuinely on it. And then his form disappeared to such an extent that you could mistake that for a Ferrari team dynamic. So
The car was more suited to him in the early stages of the season, undeniably.
That's not exciting.
The way the development went, it really went against Perez's driving, because I think what they were aiming for was allowing Max to do his thing.
But that's back to Summer's point, where you're saying like the management has a preference for one driver or another. I don't think that Red Bull is Team Verstappen. I think it's suiting them right now, but I think Verstappen can, Red Bull can turn that tap on and off. They can elect another. They can have another champion the same way that Ferrari just dumped Vettel, you know?
Yeah. But I think we'll get an answer to Matt's question when Red Bull inevitably pluck Daniel Ricciardo from the third driver
don't
role and promote
don't
him
that,
to the
man.
Race seat midway
this.
Through
don't.
The season.
No. Okay, I can see it.
Doesn't like
I can see it. I can see that happening, though. Anyway, that was an absolutely great question. Thank you for all your mailbag questions. 2023, I want a lot more listener and viewer interaction. We're definitely going to push ahead with some of our call-in shows. I think the mailbag shows have proven to be a staple. You guys are absolutely fantastic with coming up with questions and topics, take us in a direction we wouldn't normally have naturally considered or thought of. We are looking, obviously, to do our normal race reviews, and we are taking a serious look at doing some short race previews as well. Please go and check us out on our TikTok channel, which Chris has been curating. Chris, how do you go to a TikTok?
Go in the search bar.
So you need the app.
Type
go
in
to the
Missed
app.
Apex. Yeah, yeah, open the app. In the top right corner, there's a little what are they called? The little glass things. Magnifying glass. Yeah. Why is that the symbol for searching? Over my head. And type in Missed Apex.
Okay, good.
So F1.
TikTok is on there as well. There's going to be a Spanners F1. There is a Spanners F1 channel. I'm going to start posting on both of those accounts soon. So follow us on TikTok and Twitter by searching for Missed Apex. Summers, you're probably the best one on this show. And normally I'm the best one, but you're like a proper journalist. You've got prestige. You've got 40,000 followers on Twitter or something. How many have you got?
I don't know, something like 30,000.
Wow, that's so many. You're a massive deal.
I didn't buy any of them.
Hardly any. I've hardly bought any. Let's give you a few more. It's at Summers F1.
It is.
On there, on Twitter. And we will have some links to some articles. And where do you post your golf content?
Oh, there's a YouTube channel. You know, you can search for Summer's Golf and you'll find that sort of thing.
Should we link to Summer's Golf, Matt? Should we do it? Summer's Golf.
Yes, we should, because, you know, Missed Fairway Podcast is just around the corner.
You can follow Matt Trumpets at MattPT55. And you can follow little Chris, little baby Chris, at Chris on Racing on Twitter.
And I would also like to say that this Saturday is the fourth round of the Mist Apex iRacing F3 Cup. Go and subscribe to the Mist Apex Motorsport YouTube channel for that.
Yep.
And I'm going to do Brad a favor here and also say that the British Rental Kart Championship is the following weekend, which he is like the
organizer
big boss of, and that's going to be on their YouTube channel as well.
Okay, but Matt, don't link to that. Just link to our Mist Apex.
Yes.
Honestly, go and subscribe to the YouTube Mist Apex Motorsport and you can see if I can put my money where my mouth is in F3 Sim Race. And if Matt can, spoiler, neither of us can, but there is a lot of the Mist Apex crew racing in that. Great commentary from Chris and Uncle Steve puts together a really entertaining broadcast. And that'll be Saturday at around 8 p.m. UK time. And you can follow me as well on Twitter. I'm the second best one today. At Spanners Ready on Twitter and Spanners F1 on TikTok and Instagram and all that kind of stuff. We will see you, I believe, for another live stream next Sunday. But until then, work hard. Oh, we've gone jazzy. Made a mistake. Well, this is the way it's going to go now. We're ending the show with jazz. Is this you, Matt, playing?
I do not play guitar, but yes, this is the group that I played in.
Just let this roll out for a little while. Until we see you next, work hard,
my be funny kind, Valentine,
and have fun with your Valentine. This was Mist Apex. Have we got the copyright to this?
Well, I mean, I recorded it, so I'm not going to sue you for it.
Okay, but we might get sued.
Whether ASCAP or BMI come after you, that's a different story.
This really doesn't suit the graphics that are on the screen of a fast-paced motor car. Well, I guess we roll with it. Just see how long people listen for.
It's a pretty groovy version, if I do say so myself.
It will be interesting to watch the podcast stats and see. I can see when people drop off. It might even increase at this point. I'm just into it now. Chris, you into it?
I love jazz music. I really wanted to book a place at like a jazz bar for my birthday last year.
We can make that happen this year.
Well, I've had a lot of plans for my birthday, but it's I'll be away my birthday weekend.
We'll give you I'll give you my birthday this year. You can.
I
have
will
my
be
birthday.
At an event that hopefully soon I'll be able to talk about.
But I'm a 42-year-old man whose children never care about my birthday, so you can have mine if you want.
Ah. That'd be nice.
Summers, how old are you on your next birthday?
I'll be the same age as you.
Are we the same age?
We are.
I look so much better than you do, though.
I thought for a second you were going to say the same age I was 5 years ago.
No, honestly, you look like death is approaching fast. I look like a spring buck in my first throes of youth. Are you really? We're the same age. You're 40, you're going to be 43 next. Okay, do you want that birthday or do you want to give that to Chris?
I can give mine to Chris as well.
There you go. Yay!
You've got three birthdays this year, Chris. One of them
can't wait.
At a jazz bar.
Birthday weekend is always the Indy 500 and the Monaco Grand Prix weekend.
There's no more F1 content coming, by the way. I got into a thing. I really need to end it. But there's no easy way to end it now. We're in this.
Is this still the show?
This is still the show.
Oh, God.
It's just a vibe now.
Yeah. It's not a show anymore. It's a place. It's a feeling.
Isn't it more of just like an idea?
It's a concept, yeah.
It's a concept.
Some of the live chat have turned it up. They're saying this is the best content in years. Not. It's irrelevant. This is the last silly thing we're going to do in 2023. From here on in, Chris, all mega serious. Tight. Compact. Built for social media algorithms,
like a good sedan.
That's what we're looking for. 2023, it's all about algorithms, metrics.
I'm the king of algorithms.
Spanners is now a tech bro.
I'm gonna have to play. There's no other way to get out of this except to play the proper funky music. Sorry, Jazz.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.